Blog Talk Radio.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God said, let there be light.
Light, oh light,
life is a miracle,
oh light.
Light, oh light,
life is a miracle.
It's a miracle every time a mother gives birth. Tell me who can say how much a child is worth. A miracle living on this planet Earth, rotating to the rhythm of the universe. Life more precious than the rarest stone, more valuable than silver or gold. Life, the essence is invisible. To the scientific mind it's impossible. Like the secret of the seed that grows into a tree, the starry galaxies remain a mystery. Oceans and the seas, the air we breathe, God knows that I believe. Life is a miracle.
Life, oh life,
life is a miracle.
Oh life,
life, oh life,
life is a miracle.
As I turn one page of our history, I see so many great personalities, like Marcos, Messiah, Garvey, Emperor Selassie, and the great Bob Marley. Malcolm X with any means necessary. Martin Luther marching to victory. Mother Teresa, Princess Diana, even Tupac Shakur, and the one Daddy Biggie. Well, they will always have a place in our memory. And in time to come, you wait and see, they will all get the gift of eternity. God knows that I believe. Life is a miracle. Who art in paradise, we thank you, Jah, for the gift of life. And though this world is filled with trouble and strife, in time to come it will be worth the price. Life, the journey of experience, by growing we secure our deliverance. Life, the phenomenon, the prodigy, the marvel of an undiscovered destiny. So let's give thanks to our Father above for all of the wonderful things that He does. Life is the ultimate gift of love. God knows that I believe, yes I do. Life is a miracle, it's true. Life, oh life, life is a miracle.
Oh life,
life, oh life,
life is a miracle. Life, oh life,
life is a miracle.
Oh life,
life, oh life,
life is a miracle.
To paradise.
Good morning, everyone. This is Blog Talk Radio, The Cosmic Citizen. I'm Paula Thompson, and I'm with my little grandson here, Andy, you want to say a word to the folks up there? Say hi.
Hi.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone.
Andy is 5.5 years old, and he just loves to get on the radio with me the first chance he gets. So my beautiful daughter, May, is taking care of Andy. And I believe my good friend, Anne, is on the phone with me. Anne, are you there?
Hi, Paula. We were in the deep woods when you were before, but now it's worked out. You know, I guess the satellites are everybody's having problems with cell phones in the last week.
The satellites are not aligned for whatever reason. So, somebody told me that the internet is running slow, and it's because they're doing major revisions. So, folks, there's your answer. If your internet has been running strangely slow lately, now you know why. And I want to say before we go on that was the beautiful music of Pato Banton.
Video game today.
That was answering me about video games. That was.
I love it. I love the naturalness of these shows, Paula.
Yeah. Andy's he's my heart. What can I say? That was Pato Banton. Sorry, folks. You can learn about Pato Banton's tour dates and his music at patobanton.com. He has an amazing music ministry. Reggae artist, travels the world, sings about God and eternity and light and life and our future destiny and about revelation. And oh, it's just wonderful. Pato, our love goes out to you, bro. And check him out at patobanton.com. That song, by the way, Life is a Miracle, was nominated for an award, for an Emmy, or is it a Grammy? Sorry, a Grammy. Yeah, so.
Yes, it was. And he will be back. Well, he's already back in the top of his game. And we're going to hear more and more of awards. I felt that in the last 2 weeks, Paula, I sensed it.
Yeah,
he's quite a remarkable, boundless energy fella. And as you know, he truly has subdued his ego.
Oh, he has. You know, he gave up everything to do a music ministry. I don't know if a lot of people understand how dog-eat-dog the music industry is, and all entertainment industries are like that. I mean, you really, in some respects, have to sell your soul to be successful in that industry. And I think that a lot of artists who get to that level where they don't have to do that anymore, that's great, but they had to go through a lot to get there, and Pato just wasn't willing to do that.
Right.
He was willing to do it. And he came out to sing about truth, beauty, and goodness, and about God. And that's not always popular in the music industry, but he doesn't care. So he doesn't call himself as being in the music business anymore. He has a music ministry. That's what Pato will tell you. And
well, like a lot of people that give up everything like that, Paula, and a good friend, Reverend Pearson, that's happened in his life. You know, prophecy spoke over him many years ago by one of the most one of the most famous evangelists, that he would be a main thrust in manifesting the kingdom of heaven on earth. Well, and the story, as you know, you interviewed him, I guess that was a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, right.
I remember when I called in briefly. I don't know if you recall this, but it was just a brief, and all of a sudden I had the injunction. I'll use that term. A lot of people aren't familiar with it, but I knew in that moment, and I stated it very briefly, that basically, paraphrasing, pack your bags, get ready, because a big door is about to open. And he's at a marvelous church. I've been there in Chicago. Hello?
Yeah, I
was afraid my cell phone missed. And I may call you back on my home phone. I'm still here, Paul. I'm back at the house, and we'll have a better connection.
I think either Crislin, it's either Crislin or Dave Tucker.
Oh, great.
Sure. So,
great. Well, anyway, let's just affirm I have invited Reverend Pearson to step back in with your Saturday broadcast with you and me, and we're just going to affirm that he will do that later on this year. So everybody, please pray with us.
Yeah, we all remember what a wonderful, amazing guest Reverend Carlton Pearson was. What a brave and incredible human being that is, to stand up against the face of the, you know, stand up against the tide of a popular belief like hell. Don't ask why it's popular, but it is. And he stood up against it, and he paid.
Let me tell you a quick story about that, and then also, because I will put you on the speakerphone, because I am headed out to 3 meetings today for the Parliament of the World Religions. You know, I'm chair of the Partnership Committee, and I've said it before, the Urantia community is known for its unselfish service, and as far as the Parliament is concerned. So I really admire that about the community. And so I need everybody to pray for my consciousness embracing this huge undertaking. Second thing, I want to go back about Reverend Pearson. We did hear he's very excited about what we're doing, and I just didn't have time to call back, you know, the other number yesterday. Now, the other night, after, you know, Brother Howard, he's been on your show before, he had a guest preacher that was very briefly, and I honestly, I didn't feel the spirit with the man. He was in such a judgmental, hard preaching mode, and he's very well known. I won't even go with who it is. It doesn't matter. After the service, we went to eat. Brother Howard had asked Stephen and me to go eat. Well, this man showed up along with another wonderful preacher. Well, all of a sudden, he moved into that hard line judgment. Mm. Of sending just about everybody to hell except those that believe exactly like him. And guess who he named in particular?
Who?
Reverend Pearson. And you know what? I had my phone underneath the table. I'd just been talking to his associate pastor about 3 hours before and had been given the other number. And you know what I said? I said, excuse me. I picked up my phone. I said, you say that eyeball to eyeball to the man of God. If you're going to say it, you have the guts to say it in his face. I said, we can't physically be with him, but we'll give it. Okay, just a moment, please. He backed off. He said, oh, I don't want, oh, no. I, you know, he started, and I said, if you can't say it to the, I said, now you'll get on television and condemn him, but you won't sit in a room and talk to him.
Well, right. That's that's just another form of cowardice. And Reverend Pearson is one of my heroes in life. Anybody who stands up to the truth, to me, they're like Jesus. That's what Jesus did. He stood up for the truth, and it got him killed. And you know, it wasn't.
But he's come back stronger than ever, Paula.
I know he has, and that's what that's the reward, really, for standing up for the truth, you know. I mean,
and they're making a movie about his life, you know. James and I were at his service, rode on James' BMW motorcycle.
That's awesome.
But let me finish this quickly. I'll just say this. I asked to leave the table. Now, you know, most people, regardless, they'd want to sit around, you know, because of who these people were. I told the man, I said, I really don't want to be around you, because he condemned all the Indians to hell. He said, you don't know the Indians. He said, I've been there 6 times, and I'm trying to get those heathens saved. And my friend, Brother Howard, looked at him and said, India comes to her every day, so you better back off. You better back off. I stood up, I bummed my knee. It's doing fine now, but I had a beautiful handmade Chinese cane, you know, for that night. I stood up and I said, you know what we did with mules on the farm when they were so hard-headed? And I picked the cane up and put it toward him.
Oh, my gosh. You are brave, too.
I said, I'm leaving, and you get in your Corvette, and you go back where you came from. Man, when somebody's judging like that, well, y'all take it away. I'm going to put it on speakerphone. I look forward to the broadcast.
All right, sweetheart. Thank you so much for always being there in a pinch. You are one incredible pinch hitter, my dear friend.
Well, I love being a pinch hitter. That means you can,
you are a pinch hitter. Really appreciate you.
Love you guys. I'll stay on the line, and then I'll hang up in between time and get back.
Okay.
On my way to the meeting. Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Krislyn, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderfully. How are you doing?
I'm doing better now that everybody's on the line. So, you know, take it away, girl. You know what you guys were talking about. You were talking about ministering in ministry of truth to those who don't know anything about what you're talking about, you know. I mean, it's a big topic, obviously. And
well, for me, it's I think, been a life passion, and that is just to minister, you know, as we pass by and look at all the opportunities that we have to uplift fellow believers' lives. I've talked before about this, you know, there are sort of threefold commandments. One is to, you know, love God and try to do his will. The second is to love and minister to our fellow man. But the third is to the service to the brotherhood of believers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the place where I think the problems of socialized religion have impacted religions like Christianity, where each sect of Christianity sort of isolates themselves from the other sects. And granted, that's changing these days. I mean, we have a lot more ecumenism, and we have a lot more interchange between Christians. But I'm encouraging us to do more of that as well. We do with the Parliament of World Religions, as Anne was just saying, but there are many other places where we have opportunities to serve the fellowship of believers or the brotherhood of believers.
Well, you know, let's talk about this from a point of view. And someone else is on the line here with us, 714.
I think it's 714.
Brother Dave. Is that Dave?
It is.
Hey, Dave. Hello.
Morning, sisters.
Morning. Good morning.
Good morning, everybody listening.
So let me be the person who's never heard anything about this this book that you guys say is a revelation, and just ask you point blank, why should I believe that? What, you know, how do you know that's true? How do you know that's the truth? Nobody knows what's true. What do you say?
I think for me anyway, the most common phrase heard by most Urantropic readers, at least in my experience, has been, it just makes sense. And that's what I've heard more than anything. And for me, it absolutely just made sense. And I was lucky enough to find the Urantropic before I found the Bible. I was born and raised Catholic and went to church, but never knew anything about anything except for how to sing. I learned that. but for me, it just was, it just fell into my lap. A good friend of mine since I was a kid brought it home from his walkabout to Sedona and handed it to me and said, let's read this paper. So we did, and after reading that, I went, wow. The first impression to me was either this is the greatest hoax ever known to man, and if it is, I'm okay with that because I feel it was done perfectly, or it is exactly what it says it is. And to me, it resonates as truth, and I think for each individual, it has to resonate as truth within themselves, just like anything. You know, we all have the divine spark of the Father, and, you know, truth resonates with us. And if it doesn't, like I've heard you say, sister, you feel the grind. You feel the, like, oh, you know, that doesn't quite feel right. That doesn't quite make sense. Or that's open to interpretation. But for me, personally, it was none of the above. It was just like, oh, awesome. Right on. Okay. Here we go. And that's what it was for me.
Jocelyn, what do you think? What is how do you know it's true?
Well, again, like Dave, you know, I have the Urantia book teachings first. Well, actually right alongside the Bible. But I didn't, as a kid, realize there was a real big difference. It wasn't until I was an older kid, I guess, that I started noticing that there were certain things in my Christian Sunday school or Christian services that we attended. And we attended a lot of different denominations of churches overseas. But that was really when I started to notice that things would grate on me.
Oh.
And none of the ideas in the Urantia book did grate on me. I just felt so excited and enthusiastic about the quest to be like Jesus or to try to emulate the kind of love and service that he did. And the idea that our Heavenly Father was absolutely, totally in love with us. And there would be nothing we could do that he would not forgive as long as it was our will to keep growing and to keep going. That terminating ourselves, our personalities, would be the most tragic thing for him, even more tragic for him than it would be for us. That made sense to me. And it gave me a God that I wanted to worship. I really was moved by what Bishop Pearson said when he was on the show about he had respect for God, he had fear of God, but he didn't really understand how he could love a God like the one he was preaching about.
He wanted that, to have... that is it at its essence. I mean, you know, if we believe that God is the creator, I mean, it's all it obviously if we believe that God is the creator, there's an ultimate reality, and that is God. And so there is a greater truth than what we know. And we can discover that truth. Jesus said we could discover that truth. He said, seek, ask, knock. And these things will be made known to you. You know, the revelation will happen if you'll only seek it. If you'll only ask for it. If you'll only attempt to open that door will open. And that's a promise. So there must be something greater than we know. Well, you know, I don't think you have to be too terribly bright to know that. We don't know everything. You know, so that's the first step. You know, it's like the Zen Buddhists say, beginner's mind. You know what all the great prophets have said. What do you say? What do you know? And so often people don't even ask themselves, what do I believe? Do I believe that? Do I really believe that? Does that feel true? Does that ring true? And I think that's once you've experienced something that does, as you both have described, suddenly it whets your appetite for more of that. Oh, this, you know, and I love to quote this. Jesus also said, you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. Well, what does the truth make you free of?
You know, that's a really great question.
Yeah, when they come up to you and say, you're going to hell, are you free now? Is that truth made you free? Could it be true? If it adds to you doubt, shame, blame, guilt, I mean, you know, we all fall short. And a good friend will tell you, you know, I think you're falling short here. Why? Because they love you. But no good friend, my little son today, and just picking up on this aspect of hell, because Carlton Pearson holds that torch high. My little grandson asked me today, Grandma, there's no hell, right? What do you say to your grandson when he says that? I throw that out there to you guys. I know what I said to him, but what would you say to him, Chris, Lynn, and Dave, if my grandson said to you, there's no hell, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say no. There is no hell. Jesus even said the wages of sin is death. There's no place that he says, you know, the wages of sin is hell. There are places in the Bible where Jesus does talk about hell, but it appears to many theologians and scholars that he's talking about a place, an earthly place.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we have...
we have several callers, you guys, so...
we have several guests today.
I hate to throw a question like that out, that little five-and-a-half-year-old Andy, who is really interested in God right now, and I'll give you a guess why that is. But, you know, I delighted in telling him absolutely not. And the analogy I gave him was that just like when you cut a flower from the plant, it'll bloom for a little while, but it can't last long apart from the plant. And it's what you just said. It was another way. It was a metaphor for a five-year-old that I hope he understood, that we can cut ourselves off from God.
Yeah.
By being ungodlike.
Well, my dad put it to me at an age of 6, I guess it was, which was just that there is no one, no person, no thing, no situation that can interfere with your eternal progression, your eternal life. That is absolutely and totally up to you. You have free will over that decision, and no one else can ever interfere with that.
Right.
I'd like to high-five your dad.
Yeah, me too. I'm pretty happy about that.
He sounds like a great man. You know, I had the same conversation, sisters, with my son last weekend, and I asked him, I said, my son's 10 years old, so he's a little bit older, a little bit more comprehension, but I asked him, I said, let me ask you this. Do you love your brothers? Because he's got a couple brothers. He goes, yeah. I said, now, if your brother, I don't know, maybe took your toy or did something that they didn't really think was going to upset you, but it ended up really upsetting you so much that you were just crying and upset about it. I said, would you ever send them to hell for that? Or do you think you might show them how it upset you and possibly get them to understand why it's not good to do that and to never do it again? He goes, oh, no, well, that's my brother. I love him. I can't do it. I said, okay, so we're human beings. How much infinitely more is the Father of all creation love us? And he goes, I don't know. I go, either do I, because it's so far outside of our ability to understand that we could never possibly fully understand in this lifetime how much God loves us. I tell you what, it's more than you and I could ever imagine. And his eyes just opened up and the whole sky lit up and you could just see that his life had changed at that very moment.
I love it. There is nothing more beautiful than being able to give a child the real God, the God of love and mercy and ministry. You know, ultimately, we're the ones that separate ourselves from God. God never separates from us. We
Amen.
Do that. And that's what I think people don't understand. They prefer to think of God as a stern judge, as the Urantia book says, an all-powerful ruler whose chief delight is to detect his subjects in wrongdoing and see that they are adequately punished.
Who didn't laugh when they read that? I laughed. I laughed out loud when I read that. I went, oh, yeah.
Because it's like, my gosh, you know, after having got to that place in the book, I already knew my father.
Yeah.
And so then it was like, you can really see how ludicrous that concept is. But... hey, shall we take some calls, guys? We got questions.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
727, you're on Blog Talk with Dave, Chris, Lynn, and Paula.
Hey, Paula. This is Mike Bain.
Hey, Mike Bain, how are you?
Good. How are you guys
Mike.
Doing? Hey, Chris.
So nice that you called in.
Thank you.
So what's
Dave,
going
how
on?
You doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, brother. Welcome.
Thank you. First time caller, long time listener. Oh, I'm just overwhelmed by everything that you guys are talking about right now. And
well, you know, you're a second generation reader too, Mike. So and Crystalline is too, and she has put forth the idea, and I am very intrigued by this. Dave and I both found the book, discovered it. But she's put forth the idea that it's somewhat easier for you or her to introduce people to it. Do you think that's true?
Wow. I'd say no. At least for me. But I've gone through a whole process of growing. When I first, quote-unquote, discovered it, you know, when I was 19, you know, it was already in the family, and Dad had already moved out of state, so I was going to college and reading it, and it caused me to drop out of college for a while, but, you know, I'm calling Dad up and saying, oh, my gosh, look at this stuff. He's like, yeah, I know. He's like, I know, son, I know, yeah. And so he was overjoyed to be able to have those conversations with his son.
Yeah.
And then I realized, I don't know, I kind of felt isolated for a while. And then when I reached the Jesus papers, I kind of felt bad for all of Christianity. I felt like I needed to go out there and tell them something. And then when I had a wake-up call, you know, you get that rejection, or, you know, you get folks that just don't want to hear it. Excuse me. And so I kind of retreated for a while. And it's, how do I describe it? I think it's a matter of letting the Spirit talk first, and then, you know, if the situation is right, then it's a matter of really, really trying to communicate with the person. But, you know, I've been seeing what you guys are doing, and I'm like, wow, you know, I need to get out there and do more of that. I know,
well,
I just jumped around with all that, but
you know,
well,
I didn't
think necessarily that it was easy to introduce people to the book, but it was certainly easy for me to talk to them about it. I didn't feel ashamed or worried about rejection. I really didn't feel worried at all about rejection, because I assumed that most people would not pursue it. The majority of people probably would not pursue it. But I also felt like, how do I know who's ready for the book and who isn't? There are a lot of people who believe that this is really just for people who are either very intelligent or who are really discouraged with their own path that they're on, or in some way feeling dissatisfied. And while that might be true, I don't feel like I'm in the position to make that choice for them. And I don't want to be letting someone down if they were sent to me because it was assumed that I would mention it or bring it up. So whenever I have the opportunity to talk to someone about their faith, I do. And I don't necessarily, in every case, bring up the Urantia book. But there are certain key phrases that a person might mention in passing or in a conversation that trigger my instinct to bring up the fifth epical revelation.
Mm.
And, you know, the one that absolutely triggers it is if someone says that their mission in life is to become a spiritual leader or teacher.
Wow.
Then I pretty much know that this is someone I need to share this with. And as you've heard the story, Paula, I mean, the only person I've ever really just bonked over the head with it was Tim Hoff.
That's great.
Because Tim said that's what he wanted to do with his life. And so I said, well, then you have to read this. And he says, oh, no, I've heard about that. I don't want to read that. I mean, the person who introduced me to it told me about all these, you know, bizarre, you know, outer space things, birds that carried people on their back, and just, you know, sort of all these strange things. And I find that there are a large number of your Urantia book readers who start with that stuff because it was what really fascinated them. And I think the key is we have to find out what fascinates the person we're talking to.
Amen.
And so that requires asking quite a few questions.
Really getting to know.
I'd like to share something that for myself when I first started reading, and when anybody would ask me, like, hey, what are you carrying that huge book around for everywhere you go? I would find myself saying, well, according to the Urantia book or according to this book, I would find myself doing that almost as if to say, to give them, oh, well, you know, it's not really my opinion. This is what I'm reading in this book. And for me at first, it was like an escape because I didn't really want to have that confrontation. I'm really a peaceful person at heart, and I didn't want someone to challenge my beliefs because I'm very passionate too, and there's times where I easily get worked up, and I just didn't want to have that confrontation. But as I progress spiritually, I realize, you know, it's not my duty to say where it's from. It's my duty to live where it's from. And I no longer have to say, oh, according to the Urantia book. I say, what rings true to me is what I say every time. Instead of, oh, well, this book says this or that book says that, I say it rings true to me because each person can have that feeling, no matter what faith they're currently in. They can agree with that. They can understand that. And so for me, that was a huge thing for me to get over the whole, well, according to the Urantia book thing. And I had a lot of guilt for a long time that I carried around because of saying that. But I've overcome that, too. I realized that, you know, it just doesn't exist. If it's not a feeling of love, then why spend any attention or energy on it? But so for me, that was a huge thing to overcome. And I wonder if any of you had a similar feeling or experience.
I have, absolutely, and I have found that the truth in the book, and the book is an amazing source of truth for me. I find truth many places, and I have many favorite places to find truth, and most often they are books. I love poetry. I love the poems of the mystics. I love all poetry, really, and I love God Calling, and I love The Course in Miracles. And I have found truth in all of those books. I have found truth in every friend I've ever met. And I have found truth in nature and metaphors of, you know, exist. You know, I see things metaphorically. I see the truth in things metaphorically. So, you know, and I've found truth in pattern. So, you know, I think if you're a truth lover and a truth seeker, you'll find truth because you're looking for it. However, I have found the most abundant source of truth I've ever found anywhere in the Urantia book. And when you find such abundant truth somewhere, then, of course, you're going to keep going back to that source. But once you've studied it and it's become a part of who you are, then you, too, become like a fount of truth. And, you know, you're there for people for comfort and sympathetic understanding. And I have found that I can talk to people of all religions and come from that base. And I don't have to say, you know, well, the Urantia book says this. I do say that a lot. If I feel safe to say it, you know what I mean? If I'm safe, then I will say it. Because to me, the midwayers in the Jesus papers say, you know, beautiful, eloquent descriptions of things beautiful can never thrill like the sight thereof. That's the way I feel about the Urantia book. I'd love to, you know, share all of the truth, beauty, and goodness in my heart with anybody, and I always will. If I can get them to pick up that book and experience it for themselves, like you shared what your dad felt when you were experiencing that book for yourself and the joy of discovery that you found, and Crystalyn, the joy of knowing that Tim Hobbs was reading that book for himself, you know. And every single person that comes to me and says, I'm reading that book, oh, my God. I had the same feeling when my sister, I tried to turn her on for years. She finally found it. She finally saw it. You know what I mean?
You need to write a book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Seriously. Especially from the point of view that you've been able to bring to people, that's the interfaith, the interfaith point of view. Because
the interface with interfaith.
Yeah, that's the next progression. So we minister to each other, and then we expand that, and we minister to other faiths, but we do it in that eloquent manner. We let the Spirit speak, and that's the book you need to write.
The lesson.
Just, you know, say, hey, this worked for me. Maybe it'll work for others.
Very good point.
So,
well, metaphors,
get that done.
Jesus incorporated that in his parables, you know, so I think that's another good way. And, you know, and I have an opportunity that a lot of readers don't have to talk to people because I sit at the end of an 800 number. And, you know, I got a call from a guy the other day, and we have a couple of more callers, you guys, so we should take those too. But I just want to say, and just to throw this out there, I know, Crystalyn, you've told me that you hung out your shingle on Facebook. I'm willing to help. I'm willing to minister to you. If you need help, write me, call me. I admire that so much. I can't tell you how much I admire that you did that. And people have called you, and you told me that in the last few months you've had several people contemplating suicide. I had a Urantia book reader call me the other day, and his wife, who was also a UB reader, committed suicide. And I picked up the phone. And he said, "This is the worst month of my life." And I said, "What's going on?" He said, "My wife committed suicide." They're both about 40. And this is when you really have to dig deep. You know, because people are telling him right now she's going to hell. And this is about the last thing on earth that I can't even imagine someone who's just had the rug ripped out from under him completely. I mean, he loved his wife. He told me she's so beautiful. She just had her third miscarriage and it was too much for her. She wanted children. And whatever happened, the sorrow was just too great, and she felt like she just couldn't face it. And
plus, she has all those chemicals going crazy in her body.
I can totally understand that. And I think hearing those negative things, I think he needs a close, tight circle of positive things coming his way. I think he needs some people to gather around him and shield him from those negative things. You know, I think he desperately needs some people that have gone through the same experience and say, look, they have no right to say where anyone is going. They're not paying attention to their own Bible. They're not paying attention to Matthew. What did Jesus say? Jesus said, judge not, lest ye be judged. And that's what they're doing. So I'd say we get together and or whoever knows him personally and, you know, gather around him and just
prop him up.
And here's the other.
Well, you know,
thing.
I'd like to say let's put this out there. I mean, we as a collective consciousness, as you be readers, I'd like to say, at least for me personally, I don't believe that suicide would end all existence. I still believe that in order to cease to not exist, you would really have to make that final decision. And I don't think that's physically or even spiritually possible to do on this planet. I mean, if we don't understand the extent of God's mercy, the full comprehension of God's mercy, how can we ever reject it?
That's been discussed. I've listened to a lot of the Cosmic Citizens before, and I think the jury's still out on that one, Paula. What do you think? That's a tough one.
Chris Albert talked about
that. Here you
that.
Go. And, you know, part of what you guys are just saying is a lot of what I said to him. You know, I told him, I said, well, let's look at this from the Heavenly Father's point of view. Let's try to look at her from his point of view. What's he seeing? Is he seeing somebody bad? I said, certainly the fact that any human gives up shows a bit of a weakness, but then, my gosh, we're living on this most difficult planet. So I know they cut us a lot of slack for that. Because, and here's the other part of it that I didn't share. They're kind of isolated. This couple was isolated. They didn't have a Urantia community or other people, like-minded believers, who could rally around them. Because if that was in place, maybe she wouldn't have gone there, you know, and somebody,
right.
You know, and maybe had she called for some counsel or for some help before she made the leap, she would have decided not to do it. But she didn't, you know, in her pain, in her sorrow, in her desperation, in her chemical imbalance, as Chrislyn pointed out, she gave up. Now, from the Heavenly Father's point of view, I think he sees all of that. He sees the entire picture. He looks into her heart. He knows every good thing, kind thing she's ever done. He knows what a tender heart she is. He knows how much love she has. He knows that she just wanted children. He knows how much she's suffering. He sees the whole picture. And he weighs all of that. You know, it's just like Michael coming down and telling Adam and Eve, I've looked into your heart and I can see you didn't do this thing because you're in rebellion against me. That's the compassion of the Creator. He is willing that none should perish. None! But we write each other off so easily, so quickly. But our Father and all of his agencies, it's just what you told your son, Dave. They love us so much, we can't even comprehend it. There is no love that we can feel on this planet, and as much as I love my own children, I can't comprehend that they love us more than that.
I love the concept of how they describe love as being able to destroy sin. I think that is the most beautiful concept.
Absolutely.
And not just concept, but reality.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Reality that's so powerful that it transcends ours, that it completely envelops our reality.
And I believe that we can love our friends, and we can love our associates, the people we come to know well. We can love them with almost an infinite type of love. I mean, I know that there have been many times when people have let me down or have betrayed me or have, you know, in some way or another really hurt me. And I found that it's really up to me how I interpret those things that come at me. I can either interpret them as mean or cruel or wicked, or I can interpret them as weak and human and empathetic. And when I think about the fact that we're really only like a fraction of a DNA difference between us and various primates, we really need to cut each other a whole lot of slack. We need to cut ourselves a whole lot of slack. Because a large percentage of the time we're reacting from instinct. And our instinct is self-preservation and fight and flight. And all of those kinds of things are the human or the
ego,
are the more animalistic side of us. The human side of us, the more spiritual side of us, can transcend those things. But it takes a lot of work and commitment. It also, if you have just an absolutely wholehearted epiphany experience with Jesus or with God, there's a possibility that you can have that kind of transformation almost instantaneously. But even then, you've only gotten into the door. You've gotten through the door, but you still have to grow in the spirit. And that takes life experience. And some people might have a huge amount of wisdom or life experience that happens to them at earlier stages in their lives. There might be others who, for whatever reason, those experiences are postponed. And so just because someone is standing in front of you in a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old body doesn't mean that they've necessarily reached that level of maturity that we expect from this age group. I find that there are all kinds of pain-numbing substances that people can utilize to slow down the maturation experience. If we drink, for example, to dull our emotional pain, we're less likely to learn the lesson that pain might have engendered. If we deny failure, we might postpone the lessons that we could learn from that failure. There are just so many things that we don't give other people credit for. And I love that quote from, I think it's Ken Kesey. I'm not sure how you pronounce that name, but that it causes more ripples in the universe to take offense than it does to give it. And God is not looking for every mistake that we make. He doesn't judge our lives on one or two unfortunate episodes. But we do. We judge each other. We judge each other that way. And the friends that I've known who have injured me, 99% of the time, they don't even know they did it. That's been my experience when I injure people. 90% of the time, I have no clue that I did it. I certainly wasn't doing it intentionally. And that's because none of us have even our own mate or our own children as the absolute center of our decision-making every single moment of the day. We mess up because we don't understand each other perfectly.
And you know, there's a popular saying now that says, you know, seek more to understand than to be understood. And I think that what I've noticed with people in general is they want to be heard. And, you know, and that's good. It's good to listen. It's really good to listen to people. Because sometimes, the Urantia book says, again, that Jesus helped the most to those whom he said the least. He just allowed some poor soul to unburden himself, you know. And he heard what this person had to say. And they unburdened themselves, and they felt better. And I think Jesus probably, you know, I can't say for sure, but from my own personal experience, it's an honor to be there and create a safe place where somebody can unburden themselves. Now, if they go on the attack, that's another thing. And if they just want to grind an axe with you about something, That's something else, too. And, you know, it's like negativity. You can only take so much of it. We all have to carry too much baggage as it is. And if someone just wants to come along and throw more baggage on you, I really don't understand that, because I think we humans are carrying around way, way, way too much as it is. You know, if they just want to take their baggage off of them and throw it on you. But if they just want to be heard and unburden themselves, it's an honor, it's a privilege to be there to hear that. And, you know, I absolutely agree with you that, you know, we need to work at not being so easy to offend. And that's a lifelong lesson for me.
I mean, we need to have more emotional resiliency. And
yeah,
that's,
you know,
that's an area where I found prayer helps a great deal, because I don't think God has ever said no to me when I've prayed for that. I've always been, that prayer has always been answered, every time I've needed it. There's just been too many times I haven't asked.
I like it when I can read into sections where Jesus says, I forget who it was, but I think he says to one of the apostles, take Nathaniel and go off and pray with him. Because you know he's really, really ticked off at that point. More or less, take him over here. I don't want to talk to him anymore. And go pray for some guidance.
You know what, like, how long shall I bear with you?
Yes.
It was, oh, for Pete's sake.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, you know, even the master got really ticked off. It's like, okay, that gives me a better perspective, you know, a better outlook on things. And yeah, you're going to get really upset with other folks, but then you have to rebound and come back and look at them with fresh eyes every single time.
Called it righteous indignation. They say it's righteous indignation. He was
right.
He never really felt anger, but he got indignant about things. Hey, let's take a couple of callers because they've been waiting so long.
All right.
562, you're on the Cosmic Citizen. Did you want to speak then? 562? Are you just listening? Hello.
Yes, I'm just listening.
All right, man. Thanks. Okay, let's try 321. 321, you're on the Cosmic Citizen. Hello.
321 being the area code?
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that you?
How are you?
Good. Sorry to keep you waiting so long. I'm glad you hung in here with us.
No worries. My name is Wally, and I want to say hello to Paula first for the wonderful job of having this radio show, and to Crystalline for inviting me. We've had
Hi, Wally.
How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderfully. How are you?
Very well. Nice to talk to you in stereo.
Yes, absolutely.
And to Dave, who is my friend on Facebook, never actually talked to you before, but I love a lot of the postings you make, and I get a real kick out of a lot of things you do to inspire people to think and motivate people's curiosity towards the, you know, the your source of ideas, which is, you know, the Galantula. Thank you. Did you get that?
I don't know if Dave is still
with us, Dave? Maybe not.
Oh, maybe not. Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me over, by the way.
Oh, I'm so glad you came on. How did you come across the Urantia book, Wally?
Well, you know, much like most other Urantia book readers that I've read about, I haven't attended any conferences or ever attended a study group of any sort, but I've read a lot about other Urantia book readers, and much like most of them, I was in a spiritual quest of my own before I came across the book, which spoke true to my heart instantly. before finding the You Rank Your Book, I, as I shared with Crystalline on a private convo we had on Facebook, I grew up in the church environment, mostly Pentecostal Christian church. My grandfather was a pastor for many, many years in Puerto Rico. My mother is still a pastor today. And I helped her a lot, quite a bit, you know, with the church and everything, on a more of a technical capacity than anything else. But I always felt sort of a void in, I was, I guess, sort of dissatisfied with the, you know, the message that was that I was receiving. Where I felt that there was something missing there. And when I left my home after graduating high school, I moved to Boston, Massachusetts. Well, close to Boston, in Massachusetts, Auburn, Worcester area. I attended several organizations of, you know, faith socialization, like, you know, Buddhist and Theosophical societies, a couple of different denominations of the Christian faith, and I felt the same void after all that. It was great. I still listen to a lot of the organizations of faith around, and I get a kick out of listening to what they believe in and how they share that. But it wasn't until I was at a family reunion in Puerto Rico, this distant relative of mine who plays the guitar, and we were having a family party, and in one of the music breaks, he was, there was a group of them talking, and you know how it is when family gets together and they get talking. Conversations always seem to gravitate towards God and religion, especially in a family that's religious. And then he comes out of nowhere with this idea of this first two human beings not being Adam and Eve, but this so-called Andon and Fonta. And everybody was just kind of baffled what he was saying, but it caught my attention. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. And later on, his son was nearby, and I casually mentioned it to him. And, you know, what about that idea that your father was talking about? And he said, yeah, yeah. He said, yeah, we read this book at home. It's called the Urantia Book. And I made a note of it, and I forgot about it. And later on, I went and got myself my first copy, one of six, which I gave away in the first few years because I was so excited about it that I couldn't help just to tell everybody I came across. Oh, by the way, did you hear about this book? Oh, you have to hear this. You know, you have to read this. You know, and I think a lot of people do that too. You get so excited about coming across such an important revelation that rang true to my heart that I just want to share with everybody. But you know, came to find out later that larger percentage of just the people that I talked to about it, you know, didn't exactly share the same sentiment, at least not initially, at least not right away like mine was. And 13 years later, here I am. I gave my last copy away about 3 years ago. I still keep the same one I have, made a lot of notes in it, and I study it, you know, here and there. And if I may, am I still on?
You're still on.
Awesome. Going back to what Dave said, he made a very, very important point, I feel. And I think that, you know, revelation is something that the individual needs to digest gradually and systematically. And I think the reason why people get turned off by somebody just throwing the book at them is because it's a lot of information, it's a lot to digest, and people, I think, naturally need to have a process of assimilation and digestion of the information. So one of And one of the things he said earlier was that I don't get the gist of what he said. Basically, it's to demonstrate the principles that you take from the book, you know, the effect it has in your life, and when you demonstrate that in your actions, in your conduct, it a lot of times has a greater effect because it sparks the curiosity of the person. The way that I have found in this last few years that I am able to open people up to the idea of exploring a new concept which comes from a book is by walking into opportunities of exposing concepts in conversation without necessarily mentioning the Urantia word or the word Orvatan or Uversa or any of the terms that are particular to the book itself. So in conversation, and I found this to be effective, at least for me, you have a conversation with somebody and you expose a concept. You throw it out there, you know, you show them, you know, a concept pretty much. And if they almost, I don't want to say, you know, if they bite on it, then you throw them a little bit more, and then get to the point where you say, by the way, all these things that I've been talking about come from this sort. And what I tell people is, look, you know, read it and take from it whatever you want, because there may be things out there that you're not going to immediately accept or whatever, but I'm sure there's something out there that will benefit from you, and 1% benefit is better than 0% benefit. So I leave it up to them. Just here it is. Here's where it came from. Read it if you want to, and then we can, you know, later talk more about it.
You know, and
if to get someone,
that level, you have to spend some time with people and get into some pretty engaging conversations.
Absolutely.
With them. So.
That was just what I was going to say. That, you know, if I'm in a situation, for example, where I'm meeting a large number of people at the same time, like a book booth or a people's fair or expo or Parliament of World Religion booth, that's a place where people are stopping by my booth to find out what I'm doing there.
Right.
And at that point, it really is about telling them about the Urantia book,
right,
what it says, giving them a really quick overview of what it says. And I always try when I'm doing that to have some kernels of truth that are really potent that I can drop and let them take it or leave it. And you know, you get better at that with more practice, as you know, Paula. But for people where you're really ministering, you're listening, you're drawing out what's really going on for them, then you have the opportunity to minister with the gospel the way Jesus ministered with the gospel. He didn't lay on everybody he met everything that he knew. I mean, like one of the apostles said, there would not be enough books in the world to write down all that he did and said. But certainly not what he knew as the Creator's Son. But he was able to distill that gospel into the things that people most needed to know. And that isn't really that difficult. And I think that kind of condensing or clarifying or simplifying the basic gospel of the Urantia book is not hard to do.
You know, here's a buzzword that you said, and the Urantia book obviously is full of them, and it redefines most of them for us. Words like religion, words like worship, and words like ministry. And ministry can have a negative impact on people, because what it means a lot of times is clergy. They get it confused with clergy. A clergyman is somebody who is a specialist in a theology, and they're going to, you know, they're going to represent that theology to you. But that's not necessarily ministry. Ministry is something apart from that. At least as I understand it from the book, merciful ministry is a fruit of the Spirit. So I really like to throw it out there to you guys. When this fellow called his wife died, I ministered to him, and I took however much time he needed. I wasn't in a hurry. Jesus would stop a profound discourse to go and minister to the needs of a single person, even a child. He would also go and leave the great and learned over here, who, you know, the men who were having a great discussion about things so important, to go and help an old lady in the road, heavy laden with her burden. That's ministry to me. And I'm just wondering how you guys feel about that. How do you think as because really this is what we're talking about. We're talking about not imparting knowledge to people, but imparting truth through ministry.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree too.
I was
good.
Hey, Wally, this is Mike Boehner. Just give you an intro.
Hey, Mike.
I was walking. I do a walk every day, and there was a guy who had a pickup truck who was broken down, and he was an older gentleman, and I just got to the back of the truck and started pushing, and you know, we got it safely by the side of the road, and he said, you know, I really appreciate it, and I said, God bless you, and then I was on my way. I think that could be a form of ministry, too.
Absolutely.
I think that one of the things that is going to come about from learning the concepts of the Urantia book, as the new generations are exposed to it and what they're going to draw out of it, is going to be making a difference between doctrine and conduct. You know, you can have all the doctrine in the world, but if you don't behave in a certain way, or if you don't show the fruits of the Spirit, which are characterized by your actions, what you do matters so much more than what you know or what you say.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, and aren't we kind of held down by our beliefs? And the book does, the Urantia book says that belief fixates and faith liberates. So if we're acting out of our faith, which certainly belief is a jumping board to faith, you have to believe first. You have to be a believer before you can get to be a faither.
Yes.
But once you've reached the level of faith where you have absolute assurance that the universe is friendly and that all things are working together for good and that you are safe and that nothing can really harm you, you know, and I'm not talking about foolish disregard or recklessness. I'm talking about assurance that, you know, if you put yourself out there to help, the universe will uphold you in that. You know, so if we have faith, that liberates us to serve at a higher level, in a higher capacity. And go ahead.
No, I said I agree.
I have witnessed myself getting into situations of just, I don't brag about stuff. I'll just give you guys this other scenario, but I never really talked about it before, but I've seen myself do these things and I'm like, normally I'd be really scared. You know, just that's just a foolish emotion. But I was in college, and I was in the cafeteria, and you know, people gather in the cafeteria, they play pool, watch TV or whatever, and there was a girl sitting all by herself, and she was crying, and I'm like, wow, you know, why would someone be in the cafeteria crying? So I went over to her, and I said, hey, it's okay, you know, is there something you want to talk about? And she said she was crying because of her her professor was so mean to her. And so I just sat there and I just listened for a while. And I think she was French, and she was learning English, and it was her English professor was just real mean and nasty to her. So I just sat there and listened. And then, you know, she was okay, and I went about my way, and she went hers, and you know, that was it. I would hope that was something that helped her out. I'll never know, but, you know, God
knows. You know what?
Knows.
I never forget that. I would guarantee you, that, you know, there's an old saying that sticks and stones may break my bones, but names can never hurt me. But I have to insist that the mean things that people say to you stay with you all of your life. Little wounds that you get heal, but the words that get in your psyche that are intended to wound you and wound your heart will stay with you forever. And also true, the kind things that people did for you for no special reason at all, except they were just kind and wanting to help. The nice things people said to you about you, the compliments they gave you that were sincere, that were, you know, about some part of you that has real value, they will stay with you forever, too. And
I think you'd never know what gesture, what smile, what little thing you may do to somebody who you may never see again, ever in your life, may have a trickle effect in that person's life, and it may very well change something about them that's going to help them in their way to a higher, you know, awareness of self or progression. You never ever know.
I have to tell you guys, Dave had to leave because his grandfather fell down and was hurt and was immediately rushed to the hospital. So his mom called him. You got to come to the hospital help, so our prayers go out to...
Yeah, I hope everything's okay.
Oh, Dave, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, poor Dave.
Well, yeah.
No, I want to share with you something along this vein, because I just think this is such an important vein we're on right here. It's like treasures in heaven. And Dave mentioned this earlier. It's part of the story that I've shared in my personal life. The woman that I've never seen before nor since, when I was 16 years old, showed up at my house with a friend of my brother's. She was my brother's friend's girlfriend. And we were talking about, I was dabbling in a religion. And my family was very concerned about it. I'm the baby of my family. And they thought I was getting in way over my head with maybe something I didn't understand, and they didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to see me turn into some kind of religious fanatic, you know, telling everybody. And they weren't like that. They weren't fundamental in their bent. That was not my family. They weren't fundamentalists, and they sure didn't want me to go there. And so they were having that discussion, and here she is. Never seen her before nor since, and she looked me right in the eyes, and she said, they say they have the truth, and they may have the truth, but you need to decide if it's true or not. You're the one to decide that, and if it grinds against your natural beliefs, I'll never forget what she said, because it went right into my heart. She said, if it grinds against your natural beliefs, don't believe it. You don't have to believe it if it grinds against you. It's not the truth. And there was something so powerful about that that I just completely honored her in that. I said, you know what? That makes total sense to me. I hear you, you know? And it wasn't long after that that this woman told me that if I didn't convert my parents to their religion, they would all die at Armageddon, and it would be all my fault.
Oh, boy.
And that came
No pressure.
Back.
No pressure.
No pressure, yeah.
No.
That little bit of truth, though, came as she passed by. I've never seen her again. But I will never forget that truth she imparted to me. Never.
Wow.
Because it made all the difference. And I think...
I mean, I wonder if you had not heard that that day, if you would have reacted differently when that woman said that to you. It's really...
Well, I may...
Go ahead.
I may have hook, line, and sinker, Crystalline. I mean, I think that's a... But because she got me thinking about what... She turned me into myself and said, okay, what do you know that's true? And if it's not true in your heart, in your soul, don't believe it. She really got me with that. And when I heard those words, I thought, wait a minute, is this true? And I responded to this woman with, you know, you may think this is true, but for me, if God would kill my parents, and this is what I told her, I said, they're the nicest people.
I think that was brilliant, what you said.
They're the nicest people I know. If God would kill them because they don't call themselves this religion, they don't profess to be in league with y'all, you know.
That's where that fear comes from.
Yeah.
It's part of that fear.
And that led to a moment of truth within my soul when I stood up to her and I said, I don't believe it. And this is why. If God's going to kill my parents, he can kill me too, because I don't want any part of a God that murders good people. And there was something so empowering about that moment in my life. I was 16. I stepped out of her house. I said, I'm sorry, but I can't study this with you anymore. What you're saying to me is not true. I stepped out, and I told God in that moment. And they're saying, when you remember what you thought, that's a pivotal moment. When you remember what you told God in that moment, that's pivotal. In your spiritual life, that's a gold star. I told him, I said, you know, you may be just the way they say you are. And if you are that way, I'm really sorry, but I can't worship you. And then, as an afterthought, I told him, you know, somehow I think you're not that way. And I said, but you're going to have to reveal yourself to me, because I am not getting involved with any other religions. That's exactly what I told him.
And he sure did, didn't he?
I had a revelation in my hand that was greater than anything I could have ever dreamt. And this was the God. This was my God that doesn't kill good people. My God that loves everybody and wants only what's best for all of his children. I can understand this God. This God I can resonate with, you know? And,
you know what,
and
if Jesus was the person who said, you know, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you have experienced how I've loved you and what I've been telling you, then that's what the personality of the Father is also like. And it grinds against me that there are specific passages, biblical passages, that people become completely enamored with or focused on to the exclusion of all of these other things. And it sort of brings us back around to the topic of, you know, how do we minister to and deal with people who are not your Rancho Book readers?
You overcome those with good.
Right. And
I've been able to bring up other Bible passages that are so overwhelmingly positive.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That people
there
stop and they're like, oh, yeah, I do remember that passage in Mark when he said that.
Right.
Yes. One of the things that I was going to mention is this. I think, I don't know exactly where, but in the Rancho book, it mentions something about Christianity being the perfect platform, or almost the most advanced, you know, world religions, where you could, I guess I could almost say that you could segue the Rancho Book principles through. And living here in Florida, between here and this church I go to every Sunday and Wednesday and Friday, I'm probably 30 miles away, and I kid you not, I must drive by at least 100 churches on the way there. So there's a lot of thirst for new spiritual truth out there. And the way that I have, I guess, personally decided to put my little two cents out there in a contribution to the spreading of a new reality, of a new truth, of a new revelation, is by doing what Mike just said. I find passages in the Bible that ring true, or may ring true to people, because, you know, right now the Bible has several inconsistencies and contradictions within itself. So I focus only on those that are going to help me segue other concepts through, and that's what I do. You know, I stay away from mentioning things that may be too much of a shock or ruffle feathers with my mother, who's the pastor of the church. But I focus on those little things from the Bible that support the ideals of the Urantia book, and I use those all the time.
There is an excellent sermon, and I don't remember her name, but the sermon is "What's It All About?" And it's a woman who did the sermon, and I think she did it at a Methodist retreat. I'll have to dig it up. If anyone's interested, I'll send it to you. And she says, "What's it all about?" And she says, "It's all about love." And she breaks into song at the end of the sermon. Which, you know, I'm not real up on on the hymns, but the whole sermon is excellent. And that, going along with Wally's line of thought there, is getting the concept of love that Paul describes in Corinthians, and I think I posted it on Facebook the other day, is that kind of love that, like I said earlier, destroys sin and it's a divine love. Unfortunately, some people associate it with love in marriage, which is okay. You know, they say it during their vows or whatever, but, you know, Paul's talking about a love that transcends all that. And I think that's how we can transcend any differences that people have about the details.
You know, I think this is the key right here, and you said it, Mike. Transcendence. We simply have to learn how to transcend differences. And realize and keep them into perspective. One of the most important things that one of my favorite discourses of Jesus from the Urantia book, he didn't say this in the Bible, is the discourse on true religion and the second discourse on religion. And he essentially lays out two concepts. One is the religions of authority, and the other is the religion of the spirit. And,
exactly.
And he says that it's impossible for us to all see alike. That's not going to happen. So that we can't have uniformity. We will never be able to be all alike. And we see this on our world so acutely when you look at the Eastern mindset, when you look at, you know, the various different cultures of the world. And they grew up in this culture. They're not ever going to see exactly like us, and we're never going to see exactly like them, and you can't even find two people that completely agree on everything, ever. So if we stand on our differences, if we stand on, you know, our disagreements, we will never find unity of spirit, which is to say what we've been talking about. You are entitled to find God, and Jesus says this in this discourse, in yourself, of yourself, and for yourself. And to do this as a reality of your own personal experience with your Creator.
I love that. I that goes right along with my favorite movies, and those are movies of redemption. And you look at Star Wars Episode 6, the redemption of Anakin Skywalker. You look
right.
at a movie just recently came out, Gran Torino.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
And Gran Torino
was great.
It's all about different cultures, and if you can make it through the cursing and and the bad language, it's a great story of redemption, and it's about these completely different cultures coming together because there's a common cause that's brought up, and I'm not going to tell you any more than that, but it's such a great lesson that Clint Eastwood brings to the new generations of people out there. I recommend everyone to see it, just as long as they're not offended by bad language and racial, some racial language in there, because he represents this older generation that's they're in their sunset years now, Korean War vets, and then there's this new generation of Asian folks, and it's a beautiful story. It's awesome. I recommend it for everyone. But stories like that that are told in such a manner, I love that concept of completely supposedly different cultures coming together, but they're coming together on this one little simple commonality. And then they find out that they're not so different after all. They're humans.
Oh, that's an interesting echo. I wonder what's causing that.
I heard some feedback there.
Hold on. I just put a caller on. I think it's Ann. Ann, are you there?
Yeah, it seems to
Hello?
Be.
Hi, Ann. We're getting some interesting feedback, and I think it's because I just put you on the air. So
I'm on the cell phone. I'm with, by the way, what y'all are talking about, I just passed by a beautiful, one of the largest Catholic churches I've ever seen, St. Anne, isn't that cool? And they gave me directions to the Indian Sikh's home that was celebrating his son's birthday. He's a medical doctor here in Dallas. And I'm stepping in there to partake of what we call langar. And you know, I'm stepping in. Hello?
Yeah, we're getting a lot of feedback from your phone, Ann.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll go now. I'm just saying I'm stepping in with Sikh, so everything you're saying is right on.
Thank you.
Hey, guys, I know you have a few other callers coming in, and I have a house full of people that are, I'm kind of locked in my office. I took some time to do this, but I want to say thank you for inviting me, and I want to leave you with this thought that goes along Mike's last point. And basically, we have to understand that we are, when you love your brother or your sister, you're really loving yourself, because we are all one with the Father, where the Father is experiencing life through all of us. Jesus said, when you do it for me, when you do it for one of my children, you do it for me. You do it for yourself. You do it for God. And you do it for everybody and for each other. And the future doesn't depend only on your personal happiness, because one happy person cannot survive in a group of within a group of people now unhappy, because happiness can only be achieved and can be effective if it's in a group by everybody collectively. So I just want to leave you with that. We're all one. I love your show. My second time listener, first time caller. Hopefully we can continue convo. I'm going to add you on my groups of friends in Facebook, Mike, and I'm going to ask you, please, if you can send me that sermon if you find it. I'd love to hear it.
Absolutely.
And nice to talk, everybody. Thank you very much, and I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful day.
All right.
Thanks, Charlie, for joining us.
God bless you, man. Well, you know, I think you brought up such a good point about movies about redemption, and of course I'm a movie buff, so that really always gets me going. But I had to mention Babel as one that was about that too, and about the human need and the human condition and how we can redeem each other. And the other one that came to mind was the Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow, yeah.
That one kills me. But
I haven't seen Babel.
Oh, Babel.
I haven't either. That sounds like put on the list there.
Oh, my. It's really
about a shot.
And it'll get you, because it just kind of shows what it really illustrates is the chain reaction of events that can happen when, you know, one thing goes wrong, and it can be purely, purely innocent. It sounds like Gran Torino is a lot like it. From what you described, it's very much like Babel. But the lesson is about, you know, you just can't judge anything from the surface. You have to dig deeper to
exactly
really going on. And that is about transcendence. I mean, if we're willing, when Jesus said we would know each other by our fruits, it really occurs to me is what he is saying is, don't make a snap judgment on anyone. get to know them, because it's going to take some time to know what their fruits are. You can't decide that in an instant, in a chance encounter or one meeting. You wouldn't know if someone was courageous or loyal or honest, fair, sincere. You can't decide that all in just one meeting. You really have to take time with people to get to know them. You have to be willing to open yourself up, make yourself vulnerable, so that you do hear them. It's like that great movie Avatar. I see you. You know, I love
see you.
That. That was worth the price of admission, really, just that one line. I
and
see you.
That was what I was trying to say in my little speech at the United Ranch Family Festival. The one line I was trying to say in French, you know, so that some of the other people in the audience who didn't speak English would, you know, would get it, assuming that everybody practically has seen that movie by now. And it was just such a simple little statement I was going to make, and I blew it.
Yeah, you know, it's when you're speaking French, I kind of get a kick out of how you can say something and you know what you're saying, and they're looking at each other like, what did she just say? You know, maybe I said something I shouldn't. But
well, and I can speak French relatively well when I'm not on the spot. But,
yeah,
you know, when I'm trying to communicate with people who are speaking French at, you know, 120 miles an hour, it's quite a bit different than my version. And I can read French. I can read French better than I can speak it. But boy, yeah, and there's a very big different broad range of different dialects there too.
Well, and you know, the language barrier really is probably the greatest obstacle to human understanding and peace and love that there is.
Even within the same language speaking region.
That's a good point.
Because there's people mean so many different things when they use the same words. And then there's also the female version of language and the male version of language. There are different cultural usages even between different regions of the same country. And I find that those kinds of misunderstandings are so often the reason for conflict, even within the same geographic group.
I hear you. To listen with your heart instead of just your intellect, you know, so that you really hear where a person's coming from, what they're saying, and have empathy for that, you know, or sympathetic understanding, because you really hear them. I hear you. I saw, you know, we were talking about movies, and I saw a series that my sister turned me on to. It was by Steven Spielberg, who is the master storyteller, a master at telling a story that needs to be told. And it was done for, you know, TV, and it was a series, and it was called Into the West. And it was really the migration of the East to the West from the Native American point of view. I mean, he really tried to show what was happening from their point of view and how they saw it, the visionary dreams that they had about the buffalo all going away and their life being gone, and, you know, the premonitions, because they had seers who saw this coming and saw it happening and that there would be nothing they could do about it. And the angst they felt about all of this and how they tried to deal with it. And in one scene, and the language barrier, oh, my gosh, I mean, it just drove this point home to me more than anything else I've ever seen. Because in one of the scenes of the movie, there's a village, and this stream of pioneers is going by. They're heading west, and there's an Indian Native American village, and they're watching these pioneers go by with their cattle and their Conestoga wagons and their children and everything. And at one point, this cow gets away from this kid and goes and tramples the village. And this cow, you know how cows are, it was just running wild and trying to get away and frightened. It got spooked. And so it's trampling over their teepees. It's knocking things down. It's making a total mess of their village. And three of the elders from the tribe came out to the settlers who were walking by and said, "Hey, your cow is making a mess here. Can you please catch your cow?" And that's all they said. But they said it in their own language. And the settlers didn't understand. And they took it as an act of aggression. And so when they reached their destination, they reported that this village was being aggressive and was acting in a dangerous way towards them, in a hostile way. They weren't at all. They were just saying, "Get your cow," like anybody would. You would say that if your neighbor had a cow and it came and got and trampled your garden, you'd say, "Hey, get your cow." But they didn't. The settlers didn't understand it, and then the Eastern papers got a hold of it and said that, you know, this tribe was being aggressive and hostile. And the next thing you know, the cavalry comes and wipes them out. And
wow.
I don't know if that story is true. Knowing Steven Spielberg, it's probably based in truth. We know there were a lot of massacres, and. It really struck me how many things like this could have been avoided if people just stopped to try to communicate what was really going on. And when you don't speak the same language, it's almost impossible. And the only way I could think that we could transcend the language barrier is to listen with our hearts. And to approach people from love, from understanding, rather than from anger and misunderstanding. It's what you said earlier, Crystalline, that to take offense causes a greater... Was that you that said that? Yeah, you did.
Mm-hmm.
To take offense.
I use that one a lot when I'm ministering to people, too, because that's something that they can get their minds around, where forgiveness just sounds like too big of a vague... generalized concept. And even for some people, I found that love is similarly, you know, one of the people who was helping me rehearse my plenary speech was saying that, you know, loving your neighbor was just too vague of a concept. It was just not something he could relate to because he generally didn't like people very much. He found people irritating and messy and... and, you know, he was a curmudgeon. And he said, "So I'm the kind of person who you're trying to get to with your speech. You're trying to talk to the people who don't really understand how to love other people." And that was what sort of moved me in the direction of talking about the processes that this couple, Jordan and Margaret Paul, who wrote a book, gosh, at least 25 years ago now probably, called "Do I Need to Let Go of Me to Be Loved by You?"
Mm.
And it was a couple who were married to each other and who were both marriage and family therapists. And their marriage started to disintegrate, and they had decided they were going to get divorced. But they decided that they wanted to evaluate their own relationship sort of under a microscope so that they could see where and when and how their relationship had started to go south. And in the process of doing that, they came up with something they felt was fairly significant, and that was that in the early stages of their relationship, they had been very open to learning about the other person. They've been enthusiastic and thrilled about learning about this new person. And they were open, and they were learning, and they were vulnerable.
Willing.
They were willing. And then over time, they started to get injured by each other. Their feelings got hurt, or they felt somehow disillusioned. And they started to assume that they knew where the other person was coming from or what the other person was feeling or thinking. And they started making assumptions. And they also started to protect themselves from the imagined or potential pain or hurt that they expected to come. And so they started closing themselves off and that defending, becoming more defended. And what they concluded was that there was no way that you could be open and learning and willing and loving at the same time that you could be closed and protected and safe, that those two frames of mind were mutually exclusive. And when I was sharing this with the person who was evaluating my speech, he said, now there, that's something I would listen to because that makes sense to me. I am normally guarded, protected, and safe, because I don't want to be vulnerable with people because I don't like them. I said, but maybe that would make a difference in my marriage. And his wife was standing in the doorway of the kitchen, sort of leaning there overhearing our conversation, and she started nodding very enthusiastically. And it was just a moment of clarity for him. So I think that it's true that people don't really understand what tolerance and forgiveness really feels like in a specific way. And one of the things that also clarified it for me, I know I've shared this with you before, Paula, but was during Paul Snyder's plenary speech at the 1999 conference in Vancouver on the topic of growing cosmic citizens or raising cosmic citizens. And he said that it was really important for your children to know that they are always welcome, even no matter how old they are, no matter what they've done, that they're always welcome at home. And he said, and that forgiveness is, and mercy is, are the rules of our household, are the rules of our family. Mercy rules in this home. And he said, forgiveness, remember, is not for those who deserve it, because if they deserved it, that would be justice. Forgiveness and mercy are for those who do not deserve it. And that just lit a light bulb in my mind. It was like, this is something I can work with. This is a tool I can use and use over and over and over again. And I can't tell you how many times I've shared that little parable with someone, and I can see the light go on in their eyes. Like, oh, I understand.
Yeah. If they did nothing wrong, then there would be nothing to forgive either. I mean, it's almost a moot point. Forgiveness implies that some wrong has been done. You know, as someone told me once, forgiveness means letting go of expectations. And that really touched me too. That resonated with me too, because, you know, to forgive, to give before even you're asked, to let go of expectations. We expect, you know, that humans are perfect. No. Sorry. They're not. And they're going to say and do the wrong thing sometimes. Of course they are. We all are. That's to me, you know, the one of the great lessons of forgiveness is that if you want it, you have to give it. And we all want it. We all need it. We need to be forgiven for the dumb things we've done in our lives. We didn't mean to do them. We just did them because we're not perfect. And, you know, we need to let those go. And we need others to let them go, too. It's like Jesus said, make not the mistake of estimating the soul's worth by a single
unfortunate
human
episode. That's such a great line.
Yeah, great quote.
And I recently had someone who was in my community, not someone I knew very well and not someone I had very many opportunities to get close to. But the one exchange I had that was relatively intimate was very satisfying and very positive. And then not too long ago, I was confronted by this individual who said that they no longer wanted to have anything to do with me. They no longer wanted me anywhere near them because I was obviously a really toxic personality and that this individual couldn't afford to be surrounded by that type of person because of their innate sensitivity and that they were easily hurt by people like me. And I was really shocked because I had never had anything, any kind of negative feeling toward her, and I didn't understand why she would have felt that way. And I asked her if she could describe to me or explained to me what I had done. She said, well, she couldn't actually remember what it was that I had done, but it was so egregious that she knew that, you know, I was not someone ever to be, she didn't want to ever deal with me again. And I was really upset about it. It really hurt because I certainly didn't want to come across that way, especially to her. But not to anyone. And it made it especially difficult because she couldn't remember what the offense had been. And I said, was there any possibility I might have been being sarcastic or I might have been joking? Because I do have a pretty sarcastic sense of humor. My whole family, unfortunately, does. And she said, no, she couldn't remember, but there was someone else who had been there, and if I wanted to ask her, she might remember. And when I called the other person, she also had no idea what had occurred. She had no memory of it. And she is also a minister, and she offered with me to pray for this other person and also to pray for me that I would be less inclined to be sarcastic around people that I didn't know well, and that perhaps that was a part of my nature that was had run its useful course, I think was how she put it. And so we prayed together about that, and I felt better. I felt like I no longer felt attacked, or I no longer felt misjudged, and I realized that the person who had taken offense was, in fact, a very sensitive individual and someone who did get her feelings hurt really easily. And that, you know, I just wanted to pray for her well-being, for her to feel really loved and accepted by her community. But, you know, I'm certain that she didn't see that as attacking me in any way. She saw it as protecting herself. And it probably took a lot of nerve for her to come and even say that to me.
Exactly. I mean, and it took a lot of nerve for you to hear it and not get mad, and my hat's off to you. You were, you know, you've told me this story, and you were very kind. You didn't react with defensiveness or anger. And that takes a lot of courage, too. But, you know, you guys, we're almost out of time. We got 6 minutes. I want to share something, because it's so along the lines of what we've been talking about. And I said I love poetry. For me, poetry can say something that another author would take a whole book to say. A poet can say it in one poem. This is an old poem. It's called The Fool's Prayer. It's by Edward R. Sill. It goes like this. The royal feast was done. The king sought some new sport to banish care. And to the jester cried, Sir Fool, kneel now and make for us a prayer. The jester doffed his cap and bells, and stood the mocking court before. They could not see the bitter smile behind the painted grin he wore. He bowed his head and bent his knee upon the monarch's silken stool. His pleading voice arose, "O Lord, be merciful to me, a fool." No pity, Lord, could change the heart from red with wrong to white as wool. The rod must heal the sin, but Lord, be merciful to me, a fool. 'Tis not by guilt, the onward sweep of truth and right, O Lord, we stay. 'Tis by our follies that so long we hold the earth from heaven away. These clumsy feet, still in the mire, go crushing blossoms without end. These hard, well-meaning hands we thrust among the heartstrings of a friend. The ill-timed truth we might have kept, who knows how sharp it pierced and stung? The word we had not sense to say, who knows how grandly it had rung? Our faults no tenderness should ask. The chastening stripes must cleanse them all. But for our blunders, oh, in shame before the eyes of heaven we fall. Earth bears no balm for mistakes. Men crown the knave and scourge the tool that did his will. But thou, O Lord, be merciful to me, a fool. The room was hushed. In silence rose the king and sought his gardens cool and walked apart and murmured low, "Be merciful to me, a fool."
Wow.
Wow. Good stuff.
I always love that because I think oftentimes, you know, these clumsy feet still in the marl, in the mire, go crushing blossoms without end. These strong, well-meaning hands we thrust amid the heartstrings of a friend. How easy it is for us to do the exact wrong thing, and or say, you know,
the exact wrong thing at the exact right time.
Or the exact thing at the exact wrong time, you know.
Well,
I mean,
that's
just
what I meant. You know, by the right time, the worst time.
Yeah, right. We're all fools. And I hope that, and I know, I trust that the Heavenly Father is merciful to us all, because we are. We're just children. We don't have an eternal perspective of ourselves, and we think we do. You know, we think we know so well, so right. We think we're so right. But we have such a limited point of view. And, you know, I wanted to point out that you sharing, Crystalline, what Paul had said in that plenary speech and what you said in your plenary speech at this Urantia gathering that we were at in Montreal. We have varying interpretations of these magnificent teachings, whatever they are. For us, it's the Urantia book and so many others. We have varying interpretations. Each one interprets it in their own heart. And part of knowing the truth and understanding the truth, like what Paul gave to all of us at that plenary, was his insight. And that's a great insight. And we really all help each other understand the truth and interpret it. And we help each other with that, and that's invaluable to me. I love that. I love that about us. And I love the fact, when you think of it, really, I tell people there is no official interpretation to the Urantia book. I hope no one ever tries to make an official interpretation. But in reality, there can never be any official interpretation of anything.
Right.
Absolutely.
If we're growing and learning, and this was the final point made by this couple, in the book that I had mentioned before, was that we are all growing and learning. And even if we knew someone a year ago, they're not the same today. They've grown, they've changed, they've learned some things, they've gotten more wisdom. Or in some cases, maybe they've had more pain, more trauma, more
difficulty in the past year that have injured them or have made them more defended. And if we truly want to love our brother and sister, we really need to continue to learn about them,
continue
to be open to the new things that they're learning. And the benefit of studying the Urantia book in group is that you have the benefit of multiple insights to a specific passage, and it makes all the difference.
Yes.
So we'll give you that last word, Chris, when we're down to 21 seconds. I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners and
our caller. Thank you for calling in.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
On to listen to the show today. We really appreciate your being here.
And thanks for hanging in here with us, Mike. It was a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. No problem.
Come back often.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Take care.
God bless.
Until we see again.
God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless.
Bye-bye.